Hey there, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Leaders. I'm Josh. Inspiration is one of the key ways to transform, and Conversations with Leaders is a bi-weekly interview with industry key players, CEOs, financial authors, and professional money managers worldwide. Get valuable insights from the people who have seen it all. Please remember that this podcast is intended for educational and informational purposes only. Stay tuned for additional disclosures at the end of today's episode. Now, let's get started. And welcome to a new episode of Conversation with Leaders. My name is Josh Gilbert, a market analyst here at eToro. Before we get started, don't forget to like, comment, and subscribe to our channel. Today, we're joined by Rebecca Sin, a senior ETF analyst at Bloomberg. Ms. Sin has a wealth of experience within financial markets, with a vast career spanning across London, Tokyo, and Hong Kong. Her work in the ETF space is seen across the world and has been recognized with numerous awards over the years. Rebecca is passionate about gender diversity and is the board of directors for Young Investor Society and Women in Finance and Investment Networks. In this episode, we are going to delve into all things ETFs with a look to Asia, Bitcoin ETFs, and what metrics you should use when valuing an ETF. Rebecca, it's fantastic to have you with us today. Thank you for joining. How are you doing?
Thank you so much for having me here, and I'm excited to be here with all of you guys today.
Perfect. So let's start with Asia, because we've seen mixed performance across the region recently, really, to be quite frank. Most notably, we've had the Nikkei back at record highs after what was, you know, 34-year wait, but we've also got ongoing weakness in China as well. What have been the standout trends for the ETF market for you in Asia in recent years?
So the beauty of Asia is that it's so diverse. To your point, what happens in Japan could be very different to what happens in China, to Australia. And so one of the things that makes Asia unique to the rest of the world is the fragmentation of Asia. So some of the things that have stood out to us in the past few years, of course, Japan. Japan's had phenomenal performance in 2023. The Nikkei was almost up almost 30% and continues to go up this year in 2024. We've seen a lot of interest from investors into dividend products in Taiwan. That's been a huge product that's been of interest to retail investors in Taiwan. So anything with the word dividend got a lot of inflows that we've seen. China story continues to be interesting. In onshore China alone, this year they've already got $40 billion in inflows. And so this is a record number of inflows, and it's only February. To put that into perspective, 3 years ago, onshore China ETFs only had $4 billion. And so we're 10 times where we are in assets under management in only 3 years. So there's a lot going on in Asia Pacific, and we're excited to unpack it in this episode.
Yeah, and it's really interesting. You mentioned obviously China there because, you know, it has caught global attention over, you know, years gone by. It's been a region that's always been seen as very investable, obviously since COVID, and, you know, its dire performance over recent years. There's been less interest really to sort of invest into the region. We've obviously had tech restrictions in that time as well. We've also had, a lot of restrictions recently from, shorting stocks and, you know, lots of different restrictions from policymakers there. So is there anything specific that you're seeing in China? Do you think investors are still nervous? We would probably say no, given the amount of inflows that you've just mentioned.
I think the China story has really two parts. The first part is what's happening onshore, and then the second part is what are foreign investors doing with regards to China. And the interesting thing is that they're polarized opposites at the moment. So onshore China, we're seeing huge demand, and this is mainly driven by the national team, which is the sovereign wealth fund of China. They've really used ETFs as a mechanism to prop up the market and to really drive sentiment to the retail market to say, look, we're here to stay. The market is going to do well. You don't need to be nervous, and you don't need to worry, and you don't need to invest overseas. And that's why we've seen $40 billion of inflows in the month of January alone. And so that's one story. But then on the flip side, if you look at where foreign investors are and what they're doing with regards to China, you're only seeing outflows. And the reason on why that's happening is, to your point, you know, the geopolitical tension, how China handled COVID. A lot of people don't want to have China. A lot of people have sold their position in their China holdings. And so if we look at the fund flows perspective, the onshore and the offshore paints a very different picture. Offshore, you're seeing outflows in China ETF, while onshore, you're seeing inflows. And so it's a very different story. And that's what I think makes it really interesting.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that will be, you know, a market that continues to sort of grab the attention over sort of the next year. It is still obviously a very key market, as we know. So I think the next point would lead me on nicely to staying with the Asia market and sort of what stands out to you as maybe some of the challenges, but also the opportunities for retail investors when it comes to investing in the ETF market in Asia.
I think the challenge for Asian investors is that there's so many regions, it's so diverse, and there's so many product offerings. So for instance, if we take the eToro platform, you have practically every ETF that they can trade. They can trade in Australia, Hong Kong, Singapore, US, and Europe. And so it's a large product offering. And so investors, that makes it very interesting because ultimately they have unlimited options. I think for Asia specifically, where we do really well is we have a lot of very interesting thematic ETFs. So for instance, in Korea, Korea was one of the leading countries with metaverse ETFs. They were one of the first to launch, and they have more than 20 metaverse ETFs. I think in Asia, you know, electric vehicle does really well. In China, there's been a lot of government subsidies towards electric vehicles. So BYD, for instance, the leading EV manufacturer in China, has been found in a lot of funds. And so for instance, in Hong Kong, you can find a lot of thematic ETFs that Mirae offers, including electrical vehicle, cloud computing, metaverse. So I think that that's interesting. I think where retail investors can find interest is not only in the thematics that we offer, but also in the fixed income product. We have a lot of high yield, high dividend paying ETFs. So for instance, JP Morgan launched their first ever ETF in China last year in December, and it replicates one of the actively managed strategies. In Australia, we saw actively managed ETFs launch for the first time ever. So it's very interesting in terms of product offering. And the thing that I find unique to Asia is that it's very different. What you see launch in Australia, you may not see launch in Hong Kong, in Korea, in Singapore. And so each region has its unique flavor that caters to the market, and they all do really well.
Yeah, and it was interesting you mentioned there about sort of the thematic ETFs as well. That's something that I think has seen plenty of growth in recent years. We've had obviously a lot of new ETFs added, as you say, metaverse, EVs, etc. And I think what we're tending to see is that ETFs are maybe following sort of what's trending in sort of markets. I guess right now the focus is going to be sort of on AI, and if there are ETFs popping up around that. Do you think that those ETFs are sustainable long term when they are focused on themes such as that?
So that's a great question. And I think tech ETFs have had a phenomenal run, especially last year and into this year. I mean, NVIDIA's had phenomenal returns. And if you look at the returns across tech ETFs versus AI ETFs, what we found was that in 2023, tech ETFs returned 40%. A lot of this was driven by NASDAQ 100. But if you look at AI ETFs, they only returned 22%. And so that's a vast difference. And what we found was that ultimately the tech ETFs were more broad-based, more encompassing compared to the AI ETFs. So the AI ETFs were very niche. So of course they had the likes of NVIDIA, for instance. And from a fund flows perspective, the tech ETFs still managed to get a lot more fund flows. They got roughly $23 billion versus $5 billion for AI ETFs. And one thing that makes this interesting is a lot of the AI ETFs are relatively new. A lot of people are jumping on this AI bandwagon, but AI has actually been around for some time. One of the first AI ETFs is a IBM Watson computing ETF. So it's literally the IBM Watson supercomputer that analyzes thousands of data points 24/7. And what we found was that across AI ETFs, there's really two types of AI ETFs. There's the one are the one ETFs that utilize the AI technology. So it's ultimately an AI robot that's telling you what stocks to buy and sell. And then the other AI ETFs are the ones that track AI companies. So the companies that track NVIDIA, Amazon, Apple. And across those two ETFs, we found that the ETFs that utilize an AI strategy, so an AI robot that tells you to buy and sell, their returns is generally less and they charge more. So on average, the ETFs that utilize an AI strategy charges around 75 basis points, while the ETFs that track AI companies only charge 55 basis points. And then the performance also lags around roughly 10%. So the ones that track AI companies tend to perform better than the ones utilizing AI. And the reason for this was that we found that the strategies that utilize an AI generally have a lot higher trading volume. So the portfolio churns a lot more. They buy and sell a lot more stocks. And as a result of that, that affects the performance. So for instance, the other ETFs that track AI companies, they generally tend to track an index. And the index may rebalance quarterly, for instance. So it's only four times a year. So in terms of trading costs, you only have that four times a year. While the other ETF that is an AI strategy, that can rebalance every day depending on what the AI tells you. And so they have a much higher trading cost, and therefore that, in the end, affected the performance. And so we thought that that was really interesting. But overall, from a fund flow perspective, we're seeing more fund flows go into tech ETFs as a whole. So the easiest is like NASDAQ 100. And the performance is also a lot better because it's more broad-based and includes a lot more companies. A lot of these tech companies are relatively new and people may not have heard of them. So they could have phenomenal return 1 year, but that may not necessarily be the case the second year. And so tech is definitely a trend that we're watching very carefully. We expect this trend to continue in 2024, and we think there's going to be a lot of demand for it, especially with all the technology that we're seeing in Asia specifically. You know, you have Taiwan, that's a big tech hub. You know, they have all the semiconductor manufacturing chips, TSMC, for instance. And so there's a lot of interest and name recognition coming out of Asia.
Yeah, and I think the important point to take away from that is that we shouldn't be trusting AI just yet to help us with our portfolios. Maybe we're a few years off that just yet. But like you say, those AI stock portfolios, you know, have been ultimately driven by NVIDIA over the last few, over the last year or so, given those sort of outsized gains. Away from tech slightly, Rebecca, I want to sort of talk a little bit about sort of cyclical investing when it comes to sort of ETFs, because I think this is really important when we're sort of looking in a cyclical market, because ETFs can provide a fantastic tool. How do you think that ETFs can help with sort of the flexibility, but also diversification for retail investors during a cyclical market?
So I think last year we saw a lot of new product offerings that may benefit investors in the cyclical market. So for instance, in Hong Kong, tomorrow, we will have our first ever covered call ETF. And ultimately, this is an option strategy that caps on the upside and the downside. So if market goes down, you may not lose as much. So this could do well in a volatile market. What we've seen across the region is we've seen a lot more fixed income products being launched, and mainly high income products, high dividend paying ETFs, actively managed strategies. So for instance, in the US, the past few years, the most successful actively managed ETF is the JP Morgan Premium Income ETF. It goes by the ticker JEPI US. And the reason why this has done so well is that, one, it has a 10% yield, and they're able to provide that yield through their option strategy. So for one, you get a 10% yield. Everyone loves double-digit yield. Two, it beat the S&P 500 in 2022. And so it gives you a decent return, and it also provides the income. So I think for a lot of investors, especially on the retail side, looking for products and funds with income strategies can be a good option. And so in Taiwan, Korea, there's a lot of dividend products that have done really well. A lot of new launches, like Funhua had a new dividend ETF launched last year, and it got more than $2 billion in assets. And so there's a lot of ways that you can find income in the cyclical market. The main thing is just to do your due diligence and to find the right product that suits your needs.
Yeah, and you mentioned that due diligence there, and obviously that would, you know, be a question I'd love to ask in terms of, you know, staying with that sort of cyclical side, is the factors that you think maybe retail investors should consider when they're sort of incorporating these cyclical ETFs into their portfolios. You know, are we going to be seeing increased costs, you know, rebalancing? What are some of the factors that you think are key?
So I think when you think of what ETF should go into your portfolio, there's really two parts to think of it. First is the asset allocation. How are you splitting your portfolio? You know, are you doing the traditional 60-40, 60% fixed income, 40% equities, for instance. And then from there, so asset allocation is really the main factor, you know. For instance, right now, Japan is doing really well. So have you allocated into Japan? What is your emerging market versus developed market exposure? And so asset allocation is actually crucial and often more important than the product selection of which fund you buy, because that's ultimately what's going to drive your return. So I think asset allocation is crucial in terms of how you allocated. You know, having a diverse portfolio of both fixed income and equity is always wise. Depending on your risk tolerance, you may want some emerging market, you may want, you know, more developed market. Those are all different factors to think into. But when you look at ETF specifically, one thing that a lot of people make the mistake of is they often pick an ETF just based on assets under management and management fee. So they pick the largest ETF at the cheapest cost. And so, for instance, in Australia, Vanguard, for instance, does really well. You know, Vanguard's known for their low-cost product. If we look at the ASX 200 in Australia, BetaShares and BlackRock had a fee war last year where they went from 9 basis points to 7 basis points down to 6 and then all the way down to 4.5 or 3%, 3 basis points. So the thing is, like, cheap is good, but there's more to just being cheap and big. And so one of the things that I always tell investors is if you look at an ETF, you need to look at the total cost of ownership. And so what is the total cost of ownership? It's the cost of everything from the bid-ask spread of the ETF, the management fee, the assets under management, the tax implications. So for instance, depending on where you reside, it may not be tax efficient to buy a US-listed ETFs because there's withholding tax on all the dividends that are paid, that it may make sense to buy an ETF in the jurisdiction that you're in. So for instance, if we take Australia, for instance, in Australia, there's practically every ETF that you can imagine. You know, they have a very good product offering there. So it may make sense to buy an Australian-based ETF that has the same exposure. So say like S&P 500, as opposed to buying S&P 500 in the US, even though the management fee in the US could be cheaper. So for instance, the cheapest S&P 500 ETF in the US is 3 basis points. In Australia, it could be 7 or 10 basis points. But after you factor in the dividend that's being paid out and the withholding tax on the US structure versus the Australian structure, as an Australian investor, it may make sense to buy the Australian ETF, even though the management fee is higher. And so when I think of an ETF, you need to think of the total cost of ownership beyond assets under management and management fee. You need to look at trading spreads, you need to look at liquidity, you need to look at where the ETF is domiciled. And then from there, you can select an ETF. And so I think it's most important, one, asset allocation, how are you allocating your assets? And then two, doing the due diligence on the fund.
Yeah, all really, really fantastic points. And in there, you mentioned risk tolerance, and we couldn't go through a conversation talking about ETFs without talking about the Bitcoin ETFs. They've been the talk of crypto land really to sort of start 2024. And at the time of recording this, we've seen Bitcoin top $57,000. We're seeing these ETFs have billions of dollars of value traded in recent days. So firstly, what do you think about these Bitcoin ETFs, and what do you think the impact these ETFs will have on crypto assets over the coming years?
So for the listeners that may not be as familiar with what's been going on in the Bitcoin ETF world, is that in the US in January, the first ever US spot Bitcoin ETF listed. And so this was a race that lasted more than 10 and a half years. The first filing for a spot Bitcoin ETF was done by the Winklevoss brother more than 10 years ago. And so we were thrilled that this was finally coming to an end. But to add to this, there was some drama with the SEC being hacked the week of, you know, potentially the ETF being listed and then not listed and then listed again. But then it finally listed. And what was interesting was that we had 11 ETF issuers launch the exact same product on the exact same day. So globally, we've never had this happen. We've never had so many ETFs launch the exact same product on the exact same date. And so this made it for very interesting. And we called it a race, because ultimately it was a race to see who gets the most assets. And because there were 11 ETF issuers launching the exact same product, what happened was a fee war occurred before the ETF even listed. So the ETF listed on Thursday. And on Monday, some of the ETF issuers were like, okay, we're going to drop our fees from, you know, 60 basis points to 50 basis points. And then it just kept going lower and lower. And then if we take BlackRock, for instance, they dropped their fee from 30 basis points to 20 basis points down to 12 basis points. And so this is unheard of. BlackRock usually doesn't compete in the fee war, but because there's so much competition in this ETF, they did. And they lowered it from 30 basis points to 12 basis points. Six of the ETF issuers have offered the product for free, so 0 basis points for a limited time out of the first 6 months or until they reach 1 billion assets. But we've seen huge demand into this. Looking at the flows already, they've gathered 13 billion in assets under management in the U.S. spot Bitcoin. So this is arguably the most successful ETF launch ever globally. So that sets the landscapes for you. Now, what is the impact? A lot of people have been asking, why do we need this? And the rationale is anyone that invests into virtual currency, Bitcoin, Ethereum, was initially that they didn't want the regulation. They wanted something unregulated. And that's why they went into this. So now all of a sudden we've taken an unregulated product and made it regulated. People are like, wait, doesn't this contradict the whole ethos of Bitcoin and Ethereum? You know, why are we now wrapping this product into an ETF format? And the reason for that is ultimately to cater to the retail people. Anyone who wants to, any sophisticated investor can easily open up a crypto trading account. You know, they open up their wallet, they get their cold storage unit, they create a password, and then they can go buy Bitcoin or Ethereum directly. But for the retail people that may not want to go through that hassle of 1, setting up another trading account, 2, getting a cold storage, 3, remembering another password, 4, finding another platform or provider, and then trading on it. And the thing is, for virtual currencies, there are many exchanges and there's a lot of hacks that happen. You know, you had FTX that collapsed. You've had numerous exchanges that have either been hacked, money stolen, disappeared, gone, you know, whatever it is. And so ultimately, a lot of people were like, we want to invest into this asset class, but we want to do it in a safe, secure way. And that's why ETF makes this possible, because ultimately the ETF is regulated, it's listed on exchange. It gives investors the comfort that they need to invest into this space without having to deal with the hassles of virtual currencies and the nuances around that. And so that's why this has been so significant. But one of the things that a lot of people from the virtual asset space say is they like, wait, we expected this launch to be amazing and you only got, I think on the first day of trading, we got 2 billion. They're like, that's only 2 billion. You know, Bitcoin trades more than that. Bitcoin trades 2 billion in, you know, a few minutes. So what's the big hype? And so if we put this into perspective, in terms of Bitcoin ETFs globally, it still accounts for less than 5% of the total assets under management. So it's a very, very small percentage. But what makes it interesting is if we look at the advisor space in the US, the advisor space for ETF is a $1 trillion market. And so if we think of that market, and even if they allocate 1% to Bitcoin ETF, that's a huge amount of money that's going in. And so ultimately, it's now a new asset class. A lot of people compare Bitcoin, Ethereum, all of these virtual assets to gold. This is like the next gold, or gold 2.0, as some people like to call it. And so ultimately, this is now giving people a different asset class to invest to. That's different. But for most people, most advisors will say, you know, for cryptocurrencies, we recommend less than 1% of your portfolio, or at most, you know, 1% to 3%. It's never going to be a huge percentage of your portfolio. It's never going to be a core holding. It's more of just some, you know, money that's fun that you park to the side that, you know, may potentially have some upside. And so I think that's something to keep in mind. You know, it's a very hot topic, and especially in Hong Kong. Hong Kong, the SEC approved the listing of a spot Bitcoin ETF in December. And so this year in Hong Kong, we could see a spot Bitcoin coming. And the thing that Hong Kong is trying to do is Hong Kong's trying to make it an in-kind creation. So what this means is in the US and globally, all of the Bitcoin ETF that has been listed, it's money in, money out. You deposit $100, they take that $100, invest into Bitcoin, and then you get an ETF on the back of this. What Hong Kong is trying to do is in kind, which means you give me a Bitcoin, I give you an ETF. And this could be a game changer, because nowhere in the world do we have this infrastructure or setup, to my knowledge. So the thing is, this could make it very interesting, because that means now everyone that's holding a Bitcoin can now convert it into an ETF and get cash at the end. So this is a very exciting space. We're watching this very carefully, and Hong Kong could potentially be the beneficiary of this when this product launches this year.
Yeah, and I mean, that's, you know, fantastic to hear. And I think there's, it just shows how much growth we still have to come in an industry or a sector that is arguably still, you know, in its infancy, only being around for, you know, just over a decade. So there's still plenty to sort of come. And as those, you know, ETFs continue to sort of gain traction and to sort of gain interest from those institutions, I'm sure we're going to see those flows continue to grow. Rebecca, lastly, I want to sort of talk on matrixes for valuing an ETF, because the growth in ETFs over recent years has been sort of undeniable. We have seen, you know, billions of dollars of flows increasing over the years. Valuing ETFs isn't necessarily straightforward. So I wanted to ask you what metrics and factors you think the retail investors should look at when maybe evaluating the performance of an ETF and going on to actually value an ETF as well.
I think when you think of valuing an ETF, there's a lot of different factors. When you asked that question, the first thing that came to mind was my mom and how she invests. And my mom is a lovely lady, but the worst investment decision, because she takes advice from friends and family. She'll be like, oh, my friend bought this ETF. Did you hear about it? And the next thing you know, she goes and buys that ETF without doing any due diligence on it. And that's also the thing, is you end up with a mixed portfolio of all these random ETFs because your friend or family told you about it on a car ride home. And so in terms of valuing ETFs, it really depends on, you know, what are you looking for and what are you trying to get? And the thing is, there's always going to be a new ETF. There's always the hype. There's always new launches. I mean, if we look at Asia Pacific alone, last year in 2023, we had almost 163 ETF launches. This was the second most since 2021, I think. So the thing is, there's always new products launching, and there's always, you know, the next hot new shiny object. And so I think when you think of value investing, you know, go to the basics, you know, go back to the asset allocation. You know, what are you looking for? You'll always have a core holding, you know, whether that's a S&P 500 and ASX 200. And often for those core holdings, you can find products that are very, very cheap because they have the scalability. You know, oftentimes for ETFs, the larger, the more assets under management, the lower the fees they can charge. So I think in terms of value investing, there's no right or wrong answer. Some may prefer more fixed income products. You know, they just want something that pays a steady income and a steady stream. And that's perfectly normal. There's a lot of products that fit that. While some investors, you know, they prefer more equity because, you know, they're just starting their career and they don't need the money anytime soon, so they can deal with the volatility of the market. So I think as a value investors, there are a lot of ETFs to look for, but there are pockets of growth and pockets of opportunities, and finding the right one that fits your portfolio and your strategy is very important, and doing the right due diligence, looking at the total cost of ownership of the ETF beyond assets under management and fee.
Yeah, and it's interesting you mentioned your mum there as well, because my mum is exactly the same. And I'm sure there's many people listening to this as well that would maybe be in the same boat, you know, and find it difficult to understand what ETFs to pick. There are, you know, as we know, well, people may not know, but there are obviously plenty of, you know, ETFs that focus on, you know, the S&P 500 that do the same thing ultimately. And I think maybe there is sometimes, you know, investors can overlook how to sort of compare ETFs. So I wanted just to sort of ask how you would say to a retail investor, the simplest way is to effectively compare different ETFs within, say, a given category, and how, you know, we should say, okay, this is the one that I can go for, or just more broadly, how to, you know, compare ETFs to know which one is the right one for you.
So one of the beauty is that Bloomberg, as a data provider, does have phenomenal ETF data. We have the best global ETF database that can allow you to track and compare all ETFs. Even as a retail investor, you can get a free 3-month trial with us, so do let us know. But I think the most important thing is, for all ETFs, there's what's called a fact sheet. And ultimately, this is a summary of the ETF. So the way you find this fact sheet is if you type the ticker or the name of the ETF, and then you put fact sheet, something will appear. It's a PDF document that's usually 2 pages. And on this document, it'll tell you what the ETF is, what the underlying is, the top 10 holdings, the asset allocation, and what the performance has been over time. And this is a very easy way that you can glance into the fund from a very high level and see what it is that you're holding and what it is. So oftentimes, if you have 5 funds that you're looking at, just by pulling in the fact sheet alone of these 5 funds, you'll be able to narrow down what it is you want. And find interesting things that you didn't know very quickly. And all of this is available free of charge on the various ETF issuers' website. And so I'd say for retail investors that's looking for a fund or an investment idea, definitely look at the fact sheet before you invest, because there's a lot of information that you can gain from that. You know, it has past performance, it has tracking error, it has the dividend yield, and all the necessary information. And just by having fact sheet of 3 or 5 different ETFs, you'll be able to narrow down your selection much easier.
Perfect. And that's fantastic information for those retail investors that are just maybe getting started in the ETF space or are looking how to sort of allocate an ETF to their portfolio. We've covered plenty there, Rebecca. It's been a pleasure to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us today and giving us those insights.
Thank you so much for having me. And remember, the most important thing is education. Listen to more of these podcasts, read more. There's tons of free ETF knowledge, mutual funds, articles, podcasts, TV shows out there. So continue to listen to this podcast and you're on your way to success.
Absolutely right. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. And remember to continue to listen to Digest and Invest, and a reminder to like, share and subscribe to this video. Thanks all for listening. See you next time. You have been listening to Digest and Invest by eToro. For more information, use eToro.com. This podcast is for information and education purposes only and should not be taken as investment advice, a personal recommendation, or an offer of or solicitation to buy or sell any financial instruments. This material has been prepared without taking into account any particular recipient's investment objectives or financial situation and has not been prepared in accordance with the legal and regulatory requirements to promote independent research. Past performance is not an indication of future results.